Session number 11237, Reel 4.
Giles, Reel 4.
So when we had to lay these mines from the aphis, just creep in there silently at night, we stuck a damage control plank under the degaussing wires, stood a great fat chief stoker on the inboard end so that it wouldn't tilt, and somebody would walk out and actually lay this, just splash this thing by hand over the plank over the side of the ship. That worked fine. We also were told on one of these operations to pick up some British troops who'd been cut off by the advancing Germans, and we had to go in a whaler from HMS Avis's whaler and land some soldiers to try and contact them. And I remember going in this whaler, and we nosed into the sand, and these soldiers, I think it was Scots Guards, but it doesn't matter, pulled their woolen caps down over their heads and clicked their Sten guns or whatever they were using those days, and crept ashore to try and contact these soldiers. And I remember thinking, these chaps know exactly what they're doing, what they know how to move at night, they know how to contact people and everything. I was very impressed with them, as I always am with soldiers. But we weren't able to contact the cut-off Brits at that particular time. We came back into Tobruk. Then there was constant air raids on Tobruk, of course, by these Stukas, absolutely endlessly, and no fighter protection of any sort. It simply couldn't be provided. Well, there were no aircraft there. And then the Germans swept round Tobruk, and we were besieged. And there was another former Yangtze River gunboat there called the Ladybird. And the Ladybird was sunk at her moorings, and the aphis was very badly damaged, and the captain of the aphis was called Campbell, and some chap in the port party was called MacDonald. There was an air raid on. These wretched survivors came ashore and went down into the sort of big cave thing that was underneath Navy House, which he used as an air raid shelter, where we had our mess, and sat down. One of them still needs wet clothes. And I said to this chap, you know, Jock Campbell, and he glared, another bloody Campbell. And in the middle of an air raid with enemy bombs raining down on top of you, these clan rivalries still came out. I was absolutely astonished, but then I don't understand the Scots. Navy House wing was hit by a bomb from a Stuka. The senior naval officer of the inshore squadron at that time, Poland, Captain Poland, was in the habit of going to a slit trench and firing at these Stukas with a Lewis gun, for what that was worth. And on this occasion, he was down in the shelter when the bomb fell on the wing. And when the all clear went, he went up to see what had happened, and he saw his Maltese steward who got up ahead of him, and his office had been bombed out. And the steward walked across the forecourt of Navy House, and he saw the sleeve of a captain's monkey jacket lying on the ground, and he looked at it with his eyes staring out of his head, thinking, my God, my boss must have been killed. And then he described how he picked it up, opened it up, and peered down to see if there was anything left inside the sleeve, watched by Captain Poland himself, who was hale and hearty and was hooting with laughter. Funny atmosphere at Tobruk. They had a big gun called Big Bertha or something, we called it.
Bardia Bill.
Bardia Bill, exactly. Bardia Bill, you know, well informed. Bardia Bill used to shell us, and we were bombed ceaselessly. And there was a very, very, very tough Captain R&R, Frank Smith, who was killed there eventually. And he he ran them around the place fantastically. It was a, like any garrison tends to be, it was a very close-knit community indeed. And of course, the ships had to dart in and unload as quickly as they possibly could and dart away again to get back to Alexandria. And the siege went on for a good many months. I was there, not the complete siege. I was sent back to Alexandria after about 3 months there.
I think your next duties were concerned preparations for blocking the Suez Canal.
Yes. This was the time when Rommel got right up close to Alexandria, or to Alamein, as we know, and was stopped there. And in Alexandria, you could hear the shell fire. You could hear the gunfire up in the desert. The Union Club, where we also used to go, lost its nerve and cancelled its dance one Saturday night. But the following Saturday night, while the guns were still rattling with the artillery, they thought that they were rather ashamed of themselves having lost their nerve, and they put it on. It was a fancy dress dance, nice and phlegmatic. But, of course, when the Germans marched, advanced as far as they did, there was a great fear that they would come further and get into the Nile Delta. Plans then were for the British forces to evacuate into Palestine and east of the canal. It was called locally Ash Wednesday because of the amount of burning of documents and confidential books and all that thing, sort of thing was going on. And I know that all the Wrens were put into the submarine depot ship HMS Medway, thereafter was known HMS Midwife Maru, and taken out to evacuate them to Haifa. And she was torpedoed, and a lot of the Wrens were flapping around in the sea, but it was good weather, and I think they were rescued.
Maru?
It's a joke, because all Japanese ships are called Maru. And so she was nicknamed Midwife Maru.
Maru is part of the name of every Japanese ship.
It's part of the name of every Japanese ship. It's rather like we would say SS. And this boss of mine, Commander Watson, said, look, if we do evacuate there, the Germans mustn't be able to follow us. And so we have got to have plans absolutely dead ready to go to block the canal. And a dozen or so merchant ships were gathered in Portside and in Suez, and I was sent down to arrange the demolitions in them and to position them in the right places ready to block. And we were going to block the canal in four different places. And the ships were filled with concrete and railway metal and God knows what, all ready to go. But in the event, of course, it wasn't necessary to use it. But I'm not sure that it's widely known that we were making preparations to block the canal. And the idea, of course, of doing it in several places was they'd had to work on one blockage before they could get their way to the next, and they would exert the maximum delay if this had happened. Now, the next thing that happened to me was that I was told that this blockage was off, and Commander Watson had been driving round in the canal area where there were a large number of Royal Air Force bomber stations, and he'd seen a Wellington bomber, which was a pretty new gadget in those days, with its two long parallel bomb bays inside it, and its doors were open on the ground, and he thought to himself, I believe a torpedo would fit in there, a Fleet Air Arm 18-inch torpedo would fare in, or two of them even, one in each. And of course at that time the Fleet Air Arm aircraft working from Alexandria, which were Swordfish biplanes, hadn't got the range to get out and attack the German convoys going into Benghazi. So it was desperately necessary, if possible, to provide longer range aircraft. So I was told to take a truck and some sailors and some torpedoes and go down, and my instructions were very clear: live on the Royal Air Force's doorstep in this RAF station at Shalufa and drink their gin till they let you try. Well, I found them more than welcoming, and there was a wing commander chaplain in a CO of 38 Squadron, and he said, well, there's an unserviceable aircraft over there. You can go and fit your blasted torpedo into that if you can. But, of course, they were not very enthusiastic, because if this had worked, it would have meant flying these bombers right down low. You had to come down to 50 feet to drop the torpedoes. And they're accustomed and designed for flying on 10, 20,000 feet. Anyway, the torpedoes fitted in very well. And they were then said, all right, well, we'll have to try it out. And we got the torpedoes wedged in somehow with various technical modifications. And we did some test runs in the Bay of Suez. And the technique was to come right down low and fly up the moon path. And, of course, you could more or less see what you're doing then. But the altimeters, of course, were nothing like accurate enough. There were pressure altimeters in those days, and they didn't have electronic ones, to know your exact height. And it was a very difficult thing. These chaps were not trained in low flying. They were only trying for high-level bombing. And in one of these test runs, we released the torpedo and then banked slightly, but we were so low that the wingtip touched in the sea and we cartwheeled and crashed into the sea. And I was standing up beside the pilot in the aircraft at the time, so I was rather lucky to get out of that, because not by no means all the crew got out. So I was out of action with this thing for a long time, but it got quite well established. And in the end, after many months had gone past, a squadron or two of Royal Air Force aircraft were actually converted to this torpedo-carrying role. And the technique they evolved was to send one aircraft out ahead with no torpedoes, but with ASV, that's a form of radar which had just been invented at that time, to locate the enemy convoys. And then, having located the convoy, he would home up the Wellingtons, which are carrying the torpedoes. And when they were in position, chatting to one another by radio, the reconnaissance aircraft would go a little beyond the convoy and drop a line of a dozen great big parachute flares in the sky, which would make an artificial moonlight, and then down could come the torpedo-carrying ones and run in and attack the convoy. And I must say this worked marvellously well. And, of course, the Royal Air Force, who are marvellously cheerful chaps, they called the Wellingtons with torpedoes, they called them Fishingtons, and the ones that were doing the reconnaissance they called Goofingtons, and any that they managed to crash they called Prangingtons. It gives me the opportunity to say that that time, many months I was with the Royal Air Force, gave me an admiration for the Royal Air Force which I carried to my deathbed. Every ship that arrived in Suez carried another dozen or so pink-faced schoolboys who had learned to fly twin engine bombers. Within a few weeks out there, they had brown knees. Within a few weeks more, they'd been promoted to flight commanders. And within a few weeks more, they were not there for breakfast. And they never faltered for one second. Their spirit was fantastic. Their way of doing things was totally different from the Navy. Everyone was on Christian name terms, and the squadron leader was called Len and all the rest of it, but it worked marvellously, and it's not too much to say that I admire the Royal Air Force as they were then, and I suppose they still are now, quite tremendously, and I really claim to be equal in my admiration for all three services, not my own first. Well, when I got out of hospital after that crash, I was stationed at Decatur, which is Alexandria, where I was the torpedo attached to the fleet air arm, although of course I'm not an aviator myself. And I was also the naval liaison officer with 201 group, which was the coastal command group based at Alexandria, which of course operating all the coastal command effort, shadowing the Italian fleet. They had three super fortresses, or through the new flying fortresses out there, which were supposed to bomb the Italian fleet if they came out. The fleet air arm base where I was actually living, I had swordfish and Albacore aircraft. And you may ask, well, what's a torpedo officer doing there? Well, I found that they had magnetic pistols on their aircraft, on their torpedoes underneath their aircraft, and because they were magnetic, these wretched young pilots, and especially when they were carrying magnetic mines, because they had magnetic as well, these young pilots thought, they knew so little about the inner workings of these weapons, that they thought that if they did violent maneuvers in their aircraft, that the mines would blow up underneath them. They had to be explained that, you know, there were safety arrangements until they'd left the aircraft, that they were quite safe, and so a hell of a lot of explaining needed to be done. You asked me earlier on if I thought that we were well prepared for war. Well, in many respects we were not, and the things that I was taught in my torpedo long course before the war bore terribly little relation to what I actually found myself having to do later on in the war, but that's rather a longer story. A lot of the aircraft from HMS Illustrious, when she'd been damaged, as I described earlier, had landed. We had quite a big force of aircraft at Decatur, but their range was too limited. And they used to go to advanced landing grounds up in the desert. And, of course, they'd have to refuel and rearm when they got there. So there were two mobile torpedo units, which I was responsible for operating, which were a bunch of trucks driven by Royal Marines, and they'd have portable air compressors, ammunition lorries, tents, everything, and they'd go up and down in the wake of the army, preparing at the advanced landing grounds for these aircraft to come up, rearm, and then go off on their strikes, because they hadn't got the range to do it direct from Alexandria. And it's quite extraordinary, that desert life. One of the things I most remember about it is that there was an extraordinary, I think affinity is almost the word to use, certainly a great deal of respect between the 8th Army and the Africa Corps as it was then. It's perhaps not too highfalutin to say that this was the last flicker of chivalry in war, because it was a straightforward, honest, hard-slogging professional war between two very professional outfits. And once the war had come onto the mainland of Europe and there was mud and refugees and starving babies and all the rest of it, it became as squalid as we all know it was. But in the desert, it was a perfectly clean, straightforward war, and everybody was dressed in this nondescript khaki. You couldn't really tell at a glance which side was which. And if you were out at night and you heard a bunch of soldiers singing, both sides would be singing Lily Marlene. You couldn't tell which side they were. This leads to the story, which I'm sure you've got elsewhere in your tapes, about Fitzroy Maclean going into Benghazi. Well, I'll just tell that very briefly. Fitzroy Maclean, who I had a lot to do with later on, was an enterprising young soldier in the long-range desert group. And they used to work right round the south of both armies and appear beyond the German lines and try and sow discord and ambush their convoys and that sort of thing. And once they were sent with some magnetic mines supplied by the Navy in their jeeps, and they had to get into Benghazi and attach these mines on the hulls of the German ships which were taking the German supplies into Benghazi. And they got in into the docks in Benghazi, and Fitzroy Maclean was there blowing up his rubber boat to just paddle out and attach this mine to the hull. And it was a moonlit night, and unfortunately the bellows of his rubber boat squeaked a bit, and a sentry on the forecastle of the German ship, silhouetted against the moon, wandered across and said, "What the hell's going on down there?" And Fitzroy, who was a former diplomat and spoke German, with a string of oaths said, "Mind your own bloody business." And the German shut up for a bit, and then he became a bit more suspicious. and he rang up somebody, and then lights began to go on and dogs began to bark, and it was clear that the Long Range Desert Group people partly had to get out of it in a hell of a hurry. Well, the lights were going up all around the wire and so on, and Fitzroy should tell this story, not me, but he then apparently stormed up to the main gate dressed in his nondescript khaki and shouted at the NCO, "Come on, turn out the guard there. What the hell do you think you're doing lurking around in that hut when there's all this scare on? Haven't you heard there's alarm, that sort of business? I mean, why don't you brace yourselves up and look a bit more alert? I mean, I might be a British officer, mightn't I?" And stormed off into the night. The picture of an infuriated German staff officer and got clean away with it. I hope that Sir Fitzroy McLean is going to be interviewed by your group, and he will, I hope, tell that story.
I think it's coming off soon. But wasn't he in the SAS rather than the Long Range Desert Group?
The SAS grew out of the Long Range Desert Group.
So you were at Decalia doing this work, liaison work,
yes,
you were saying.
Yes, that's right. And I worked there for a good many months with the Fleet Air Arm. And then out of the blue, the Fleet Torpedo Officer sent for me and said, "You've got to go to Malta and be Staff Officer Operations to Coastal Forces there." And I was a bit upset because I'd got very interested in aircraft work by this time. And incidentally, after my air crash in the Wellington, no, that's a different air crash, sorry. When I was in the desert at this time, you could move around the desert. It's difficult to describe the atmosphere. You could move around the desert just by hitchhiking an aircraft, really. And I wanted to get back from Benghazi, as we were advancing well forward. And I came to an American aircraft called Dakota. And I said, "You know, you going back to Cairo, bud?" "Yeah, hop in," he said, you see. And I hopped in. And in it were two big engines from crashed Hurricane fighters, which they rescued. It wasn't worth taking the rest of it, but the engine was worth salvaging. They'd been salvaged and brought into Benghazi, and an empty aircraft would fly them back to be used again in Cairo. And a bunch of American colonels were sitting up forward, and there wasn't much room for me, so I sat in the tail. Well, we bounced and banged our way over the desert, and we got back to Cairo very late. And there was a searchlight exercise on. And the searchlights mistook our late arriving aircraft over Heliopolis Airport for their target, which they're supposed to be exercising with, and focused on this wretched aircraft. Well, of course, the pilot was totally blinded by these searchlights. He didn't know what was supposed to be going on. He didn't know the exercise it was on or anything, and he didn't know Heliopolis. So he made a pass at the runway and landed it so hard that the thing caught on fire and burnt out, and all the American colonels were smashed up by bashed up by these salvage engines which were sitting in the belly of the aircraft. And I remember nothing about it at all, except I woke up in hospital where the cool hand of the Australian nurse on duty belonged to the girl who subsequently became my wife, but that again is another story. And I wasn't out of action for more than a few days over that. But very shortly afterwards, as I've just described, I was ordered to go to Malta and stop playing with the air altogether.
What date have we reached now?
We reached about 1940.
Here you put 43.
It's 42, I think.
Do you know when in 42 it would have been about?
So, very early in 1943, I was sent to Malta to be Staff Officer Operations on the staff of Captain Coastal Forces. We had a large number of motor torpedo boats and motor gunboats then. The job didn't last very long at all, but it was there that I had the opportunity to learn something about coastal forces and the people in them and so on, which came very useful to me later on in this story. The Blitz was over in Malta by this time. It was uncomfortable but not dangerous, you might say. And from there, I was moved again at short notice to... Oh yes, an interesting thing that happened in Malta at that time was everybody who knew about the ultra top secret decoded was put on a special list, and you had to sign more or less in your lifeblood that you would never mention the thing again as long as you lived, that these so much successful de-encrypting was being done of the enemy signal traffic. And I was put on this list because I used to have to go down into the opera room and see where the if they knew anything about where the German convoys were expected to go that night, so the motor torpedo boat patrols could be put in the proper positions. And if you'd been on that list and knew about this secret, you were supposed never to be put anywhere where you might be taken prisoner. But later on, as you'll be describing, I was sent to Yugoslavia, where I was in daily prospect of being taken prisoner for many, many months. But it was merely that the administration of this list hadn't caught up, and I should never have been sent there. But from my point of view, there was a much worse thing, and that was I was being told by my boss in the Italian mainland where to operate the patrols, and I wasn't able to tell the coastal forces people, the people in the motor torpedo boats, why they were being sent there. And they thought, why does this bloody man send us here? We never see anything. And send them out night after night after night when they were red-eyed with sleep. I said, you have to go out again tonight. And it was a very awful thing for me because I knew why they were being sent out there, and I wasn't allowed to explain why we were doing it. But that's rather an aside to the narrative of this, because that's where I got on the list about the decrypting signals. And I think I'm right, yes. While I was there, Admiral Power, or Commander Power as his name was, who was Staff Officer Plans, was in charge of the operations room, and I know that subsequently in that operations room he sat down, and for 3 days and three nights, I am told, he wrote the plan for the invasion of Sicily, which happened shortly after this. And there were so many staff officers flying to and across the Atlantic with bulging briefcases and trying to get international agreement about it and so on, that in the end, the time came when it had to be done, and there was no other plan which was sufficiently put together, and this one-man plan of lofty power was the one which actually put into effect. I was taken out of that after a relatively short number of months and sent back to Cairo, which was, so to speak, my headquarters, where I worked on plans for the invasion of Sardinia. Well, I've since come to realize that was just a cover plan, and I suppose it was probably we didn't leak it out, but I suppose it was probably leaked out, because in fact it was meant to disguise the fact and make and disinformation that we were going to go to Sardinia instead of Sicily, where we eventually went. And in this planning, I just put this in to give you the sort of feeling there was in those days. In this planning team, there was an extraordinary old man called Flatfoot Pearson. And I'd met him before in the mining time in the Suez Canal. He was put on this staff. And he had left the Navy in 1919 as a sub-lieutenant under the Geddes Axe. He'd gone out to South Africa. He'd bought a farm. He'd driven up there to take possession of his farm. He'd been driven off the farm by lions. He shot the lions and went back to his farm after a bit, got the farm